Okay. All right, folks. All right, well, let me try to sort of speed through this. I'm sorry for lecturing so much, but at the beginning, and I want to get you up to the point where we can actually have meaningful discussions. And it's difficult to do that unless you're sort of filled in a bit on the early development of Greek moral philosophy. Hey, folks. Sorry about all this moving around, but we will do our best to weather the insanity of a bureaucracy. Okay. Socrates raises the question that subsequent Greek philosophers have to answer, namely, what is the good? What is the best way for people to live? What's the meaning of the virtues? These questions are all connected with one another in ancient Greek thought. His student, Plato, tries to answer them. And he answers them with a philosophy that has been tremendously influential, that is beautifully written, and that appeals to the most elevated feelings of human beings, and that is virtually useless when it comes to answering the question, what should I do in the context of particular circumstances? For Plato, the good is a transcendent entity. It is the source of everything that exists. It is what Christian Platonists, and there were many, would later call God. Plato develops an elaborate theory of how the good is present in objects of ordinary experience. But as I said, the theory has almost no bearing on the concrete questions that people face. How ought I to act in this particular set of circumstances? Aristotle points this out. Aristotle was Plato's student, and Aristotle represents the anomaly of a second great mind philosophizing within a single generation, or actually within the next generation. Alfred North Whitehead said that the whole of Western philosophy, he was a 20th century British philosopher, he said the whole of Western philosophy is nothing but a series of footnotes to Plato. And that's largely true. Plato is a dominant influence on everything that comes after him. And Thomas Aquinas, who was the great Catholic theologian, still has had an enormous influence, certainly on Catholic theology, referred to Aristotle as the philosopher. Dante, the great medieval poet, called him the master of those who know. In other words, you have two figures here who are equal in status. And their status is that of the most brilliant minds who have ever thought. Now, this is really quite a turn of events, just separated by a generation. Aristotle entered Plato's school, which was called the Academy, from which we get our word academic. All right? He was Plato's student in the Academy, but from the very beginning, he took issue with Plato. He was deeply influenced by Plato, but also struck out on his own path. And he did this at one and the same time. He is, I guess you could call him, a revolutionary Platonist, or a reform Platonist, or a Platonist who takes Plato in a very different direction. And what Aristotle says is that a moral philosophy that cannot answer the question, what ought I to do in a particular set of circumstances, is useless. When it comes to moral philosophy, or when it comes to ethics, Aristotle says, we don't want to know what the good is. We want to know how to do the good. We don't want to know what the good is. We want to know how to do the good. And he compares moral philosophy to envisioning a target on the back of a deer. Say you go deer hunting with a bow and arrow, as the Greeks did. It helps, according to Aristotle, to visualize a target, with concentric circles and a bullseye, on the back of the deer, because by visualizing the target, it's easier to get a bead. I know I'm shooting, right? But we're talking about a bow and arrow. It's easier to get a bead on the spot on the deer that you're going to release the arrow on. You have a higher likelihood of killing the deer. Moral philosophy is like that, Aristotle says. Moral philosophy helps us envision a target that we can aim at when we have to answer the question, what should we do in a given set of circumstances? Now, how does he proceed? Well, he proceeds by drawing a distinction. And the distinction is between human nature as it is when people start out in life, and human nature as it could be were people to fully realize their human potentials. But the way that Aristotle expresses it is, he says, there's a difference between human nature as it is when we start out and human nature as it could be if people were to realize the good that is their natural end. First of all, notice that this conception operates with the idea of a natural end. There is an end or a purpose, a goal state, that is natural to human beings. Everything that exists has an end, a purpose, a goal state that is natural to it. This eraser, the Greeks would say, is made up largely of earth. There are four elements in ancient Greek thought. There's earth, air, what?
Fire
and water. Earth, air, fire, and water are the four elements the Greeks operated with. Everything material is a mixture of elements. This eraser is a mixture mostly of earth and air. But the earth predominates, and we know that the earth predominates because why? Because when I drop the eraser, it tends to move toward the place that is appropriate for it. It tends to seek the center of the earth. It's made up of earth, and it tends to seek the place that is natural to earth, namely, the center of the cosmos. The Greeks, of course, believed that the earth was at the center of the cosmos, and they were right, by the way. The idea that the earth is not the center is a great error that's been in place for about 400, 500 years. Actually, we're told by modern cosmologists that there is no center, or another way of putting it is we're told by modern cosmologists that every point in the universe is a center. Wherever you are, you're at the center of the universe. Well, that aside, the Greek view, the Aristotelian view, is that the earth is at the center, and when I drop this thing that's made up mostly of earth, it tends to move to its natural goal, which is location at the center of the earth. Of course, it's stopped by the podium, or it's stopped by the floor, or it's stopped by the ground. You know, there's something solid between it and the center, but it tends to move toward the center of the earth. Plants are material in character. Plants are made up of earth and air and water, right? Maybe some fire, the Greeks would say. But once again, we know that earth predominates in the makeup of plants, because if you take a plant and you uproot it and you hold it up here and you drop it, it's going to drop toward the center of the earth. But a plant is different than an inanimate material thing. What can a plant do that this thing cannot do? Say it.
Grow.
Yeah. The eraser doesn't grow. I can plant the eraser in the ground, but it's going to eventually disintegrate. It's not going to develop. It's not going to become bigger. It's not going to send out shoots or tendrils or anything else. The eraser doesn't grow, but plants do. What else do plants do that this doesn't?
Move towards light.
Yeah, although that kind of motion is very marginal. It's true that there is some motion in plants, but not all plants move. What do all plants do that the eraser doesn't do?
Reproduce.
Say it again?
Reproduce.
It reproduces. Yeah, plants reproduce. New members of the species. I can leave this the racer here, I can even find a nice looking mate for it. And I can put the two of them together and I still won't get little erasers. I've tried this, by the way. It doesn't work. Plants reproduce. Material inanimate objects do not reproduce. What else do plants do that inanimate material objects do not do?
They die.
Oh, yeah. They return to an inert material condition, but then this is already in an inert material condition.
They feed on water.
Yeah, they feed. They take in nutrients from the outside. There are three functions that plants have that inanimate things do not have. They grow, they reproduce, and they metabolize. They take in nutrients from the outside, and they incorporate those nutrients into their own substance. Animals have a plant-like layer. Plants have a material layer. A plant is made up of earth and air and water and so forth. But a plant over and above that material layer engages in three functions that inert, inanimate material objects don't engage in: nutrition, growth, and reproduction. Animals have a material layer, an inert material layer. Now you pick up a pig and you drop it, it falls to the earth, right? Animals also have a plant-like layer to them. They reproduce, they metabolize, they grow like plants. As a matter of fact, medically we refer to patients that are reduced to metabolism and growth. Reproduction we generally overlook in these cases. Metabolism and growth, we refer to such human patients as in persistent vegetative states. They are vegetative. In other words, their peculiarly animal functions have ceased. And if they continue to do the things that plants do. What do animals do that plants do not?
Reason.
Say it again? They reason?
Yeah.
Animals?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said human.
No. What do animals do? What do non-human animals do?
Oh, motion.
Motion?
Yeah.
They move through the world? What else do they do?
Think.
Maybe in some sense. Well,
there's something going on there.
There's something going on.
The dumbest
on
dog.
There. Whether it's thought, there's something going on. But what do they do that's obviously different than plants? They have some kind of communication. They signal to one another for very weeks. Yeah. But motion and what? What's some other major distinguishing characteristic of an animal? But animals just move around like this.
They have senses.
They have senses. They perceive and they move. And these things are related, obviously. You can't guide motion without perception. Unless you have some perception of the world around you, then motion is useless. It's random. It doesn't have any purpose. Right? Perception and and if you perceive the world and you can't move, boy, how frustrating must that be? You just have to stand there while the predator comes and begins chewing on you, right? Perception and motion come in a pair. They're related to one another, and they are definitive of what it means to be an animal. Now, in other words, animals are material too. They have a plant-like layer. They grow, they reproduce, they take in nutrients. They're specifically animal functions are motion and perception. The good of a plant is healthy nutrition, growth, and reproduction. If you have a plant in your garden and it's developing luxuriant leaves and it's taking in the water and minerals from its roots and photosynthesizing through sunlight and it's reproducing new members of its species, and that is the good that is natural to a plant. That is a plant realizing its natural end. If you have an animal that moves swiftly and with agility, that has refined perceptual capabilities, then you have an animal that is realizing the good that is natural to animals. I mean, think about the owl, you know, the barn owl flying in the sky, way the hell up, and they can see a field mouse this big in the grass. Well, that's a perceptual capability that you and I don't have. And its ability to fly and to move and to turn on a dime and so forth is a facility with motion that you and I don't have. That is the natural good of a barn owl, to be able to fly well like that and to be able to see clearly at a distance. Those are the functions that belong to that animal. And the excellent performance of those functions is what is the natural good of that animal. Human beings are animals too. Aristotle is very clear about this. Aristotle, by the way, was a biologist, and half of the works he left behind were works in biology. His father was a doctor, and he developed an interest in biology from his father, and then went on to probably become the most important biologist prior to Darwin, the most influential biologist prior to Darwin. We are animals too. We belong to the class Zoon. Zoon is Z-O-O-N. And it's the word that we get our word zoo from. We belong to the class Zoon. We are animals. But human beings are animals of a special kind. What is it that human beings do that other animals cannot do? What is the function that is unique to human beings? And I don't mean unique to everybody that you know. I mean, what is that capacity that is unique to human beings? And that many human beings don't exercise very well.
The capacity to reason?
Yeah. Aristotle says, I don't see where I've got a marker. I don't seem to have one. Aristotle says that human beings are zoon logikon. Zoon logikon.
There's one up there, are there?
Yeah, somebody took it. Maybe it was me. Yeah, I had one, but I'm always losing those things. Logikon is L-O-G-I-K-O-N. And they are animals with the logos, L-O-G-O-S. Logos is one of those funny words in Greek that means everything. It means word, it means language, it means speech, it means communication, it means proportion, mathematical proportion, it means thought, it means reason, and half a dozen other things. Human beings are the beings with the logos. Now, basically, there are three things that come together here in Aristotle's concept of human beings as zoon logikon. Human beings are beings who speak, who think, and who reason. And all three of those are intimately tied up with one another. You can't reason without speech. Even if it is only the speech that you give to yourself. It doesn't have to be articulated. You don't have to say it to somebody else. You might be, as we say now, subvocalized.